Being LGBTIQ plus doesn't mean you will automatically have issues with your mental health. However, statistics suggest that they are at a higher risk of experiencing poor mental health. A recent Stonewall study found that over the previous year, half of LGBTIQ plus people had experienced depression, and 3 in 5 had experienced anxiety. 1 in 8 LGBTIQ plus people that were aged 18 to 24 had attempted to end their life, and almost half of trans people had thought about taking their life. There are so many complex talking points behind those statistics. So on this mental health podcast special, we're going to raise awareness, highlight individual experiences, and try and unpick some of those topics. Joining us throughout the episode, we have 3 very special guests. First, it is a warm welcome to Karina Murray from Sporting Pride Ireland. Welcome to the show, Karina.
Thank you.
Next, we have a journalist and current assistant editor of Goal, Emma Smith. Welcome, Emma.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Martin Stark, the founder of the World Gay Boxing Championship, who wasn't able to join us on this main group call. He's based in Sydney, after all, so time difference does kind of play a part there. But thanks to the power of podcast editing, you'll hear him later on in this podcast. Right then, enough of me rambling on at the start. And a huge thank you, Karina and Emma, for lending your voices to this particular mental health discussion podcast. Lots of points that I'm sure we're going to get to at various stages throughout the episode as well. But shall I start off with essentially digging into your own personal stories and your own experiences before I throw open to a wider discussion on some of the issues that we can pick apart? Karina, if I begin with you, mm-hmm. Can you just take us through what I'm essentially calling your coming out journey? Because seeing like-minded people, I gather, played a large part in you being able to come out.
Yeah, it definitely did. So I suppose I began to realise my sexuality probably around the age of 12 or 13. So in Ireland, I'd have been transitioning from primary school into secondary school. And it was around that time that I suppose I felt the same sex attraction. And of course, it just totally freaked me out. Of course, all my friends were talking about, you know, fellas and falling in love and things like that. And I just had no interest. And I just decided, well, look, I just keep to myself and I'll just do my own thing without actually having any words for what I was experiencing. Like, I didn't know I was a lesbian or, you know, you're bisexual or anything. I just thought it was different. But what that was, I didn't know. As I got older, though, I suppose the visibility piece was very important. I actually made all of my LGBT friends online. There was an online forum called Queer ID. You essentially sign up and you talk about different topics, whether it was music, whether it was sport, whether it was whatever was going on in the news that day. But it was all LGBT people who were using this forum. This is the first time I'd ever engaged with people of my sexuality. They started giving me words and names and descriptions of these kind of experiences and what was going on. I was like, oh my God, I'm not alone. Just because there's no one here in my hometown doesn't mean that, you know, finally LGBTQ plus people don't exist and that I now kind of have a community. So it did actually start online. And then I started going to Dublin, I suppose, because I'm from a small town. And then I finally got to meet face-to-face people in my community and I felt like I'd met my peers and these people have the same experiences as me. It's only then that I kind of began to accept myself. And I suppose, yeah, that teenage struggle really was a very difficult time for me. But then my late teens, early 20s, I really picked up. And it's only because I found my community eventually, you know.
Those teenage struggles that you mentioned, was that feeling alone part of it? That was, I suppose, one of the main struggles behind it all.
It was definitely loneliness and uncertainty about my future and I suppose what was the difference. As I said, I'm in my 30s now, so it wasn't so visual. Like, I didn't have social media. I didn't have people online until I found the Queer ID site. So it was definitely a loneliness and also a fear, because I suppose I would have been quite religious myself and came from a religious family. And that would probably actually be my only knowledge around same-sex attraction is what was spoken about in the church. And I suppose that negative effect that had on me in terms of thinking, well, I'm one of these people now and what's going to happen to me. And again, I didn't come out of that until I was in my 20s and realized, no, it's OK, you know, to be who you are and to love who you love, things like that.
And I think I caught in a previous interview that you'd done that you were originally quite, you know, a confident person, but then mm-hmm. almost kind of withdrew into yourself and became shyer when you were going through that, I suppose, identity acceptance, if you like. Is that very much the case?
Yeah, definitely. I suppose I'm shyer because I had a secret. I was hiding something, you know, I didn't want people to know something about me. So now I had to be introverted, because the more extroverted you are, the more attention you're going to get, I would assume. And that if I don't want people to know about this difference, I now have to take a step back and essentially not be myself anymore while I keep this hidden secret to myself. Now, no one will know, just me. So it was easier to be shyer, I think. I recognize now, looking back, it wasn't, and I wish things had been different. But at the time, I think it was easier to regress a bit into myself.
How important was sport to you, but also the LGBTQ clubs in your, I suppose, acceptance?
Oh, it's amazing, because I've always loved sports. So I'm a couch sport fanatic as well as being a playing sport fanatic. I would have played sport a lot as a young person, so as a child until 12, 13. And then I reached that age where a lot of girls, I suppose, drop out of sport. But I was going through that difficult phase as well. And I kind of took a step back from team sports because I suppose that difference and that regression again. I kept up fitness through the gym throughout my teenage years and 20s as well. It wasn't the same. It's not the same as being part of a team and making connection with other people. I think that's a fact that, well, not everyone knows, but that I suppose certain people who've engaged in team sports might know. But then when you look at the LGBT communities, and again, unfortunately, they're still not available in my part of the country over on the West Coast. I live in Clare and we don't have any LGBT sports clubs over here. But when I moved to Dublin, I got to know about there's hockey team, there was soccer, there's rugby, there's badminton, there's everything. And these are groups of LGBTQ plus people who are meeting in a safe space to do physical activity together and to socialize together. And I think for mental health, from a mental health perspective, peer support is something that needs to be utilized more in terms of keeping well and staying well and health promotion. So I think a lot of the times when we think of mental health, we think of depression and anxiety and these things, but we don't often think about in terms of mental health, what we can do to keep ourselves well. And engaging in sport, in physical activity with these LGBT sports clubs is something that I think can be very, very important for members of our community. And that, I suppose, I would like to get that message out there to people who, I suppose, hesitate to take up sports and with these very inclusive communities that that you should really go outside your comfort zone and maybe give it a go, because they have made a difference to me and I know they make a difference to other people at this time.
Yeah, very well said. And something we mentioned so often on this podcast is how beneficial sport can be for your mental health, something both me and Will, as the presenters on the show, know very, very well ourselves. I'll quickly touch on Sporting Pride Ireland now, because you mentioned there about, you know, some corners of Ireland haven't got these LGBTQ clubs to help people and help people come to terms with themselves. So how did the organisation come about and what's it trying to achieve?
So it's basically essentially a group of LGBT community members prior to the gay games in Paris in 2018 came together to try and get a big team of Irish representatives going to the gay games. I think they had about 130 people going in the end. And it was off the back of this tournament that Sporting Pride started, and I would have met them straight after the tournament. It was essentially the experience at the games of that inclusivity and that connectedness and the power of sport and everything like that. And that kind of brought us together to realize that this is something that, first of all, we want to bring to Ireland. We did talk about that straight away, even though it was very early days. But this is something that we don't have in Ireland. We don't have organizations like Pride Sports or Stonewall or, you know, Leap Sports in Scotland who are working, you know, with Sport Ireland or working with the national governing bodies who are trying to make sport more inclusive, or they don't seem to recognize the importance of considering LGBT inclusion in sport and who's going to take that on. And I suppose that's where we decided Sporting Pride could come in. And I suppose since we got started, it's worked very successfully. We have great engagement with Sport Ireland. They have a diversity and inclusion officer named Helen McHugh, who's absolutely amazing. They are taking on a big piece of research at the moment. So they did an online survey, face-to-face interviews, and they're doing focus groups with members of our community around how to make sport more inclusive. And we're kind of heavily involved in that. And it's just then the individual national governing bodies and how we can work with them in terms of helping them with inclusive policies to support our community. I suppose at the moment, the last piece of work that we're doing as well is we're doing online events. And that's basically around increasing visibility of members of our community in sports. That's if you look at our national, we have a national LGBTI plus inclusion strategy for the next 4 years. And one big piece of that is visibility of our community members and how can we be seen more. So we are using the online space with our media partners, GCN, to provide a platform to LGBT sports people, both at the elite level, retired athletes, and our LGBT sports clubs to increase their visibility, talk about their experiences with sport and promote sports to other people. So that's kind of our ongoing COVID work until we get back to face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've all got used to an online world now, haven't we?
That's it. You have to. You've no choice.
Exactly. And you touched on the Gay Games there. Mm. In terms of that as an organisation, how much good can that do? And how much does it really, I suppose, need promoting? And like I say, the visibility side of things, it must be so, so important for helping those.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason we want to have the Gay Games in Ireland is the legacy it would leave. Like, as I said, sometimes it takes a bit of convincing as to why do specific policies or tournaments or events for LGBTI plus community members. It's because these games were created because we often feel left out of certain spaces. Like if you think men's soccer, I think, is one of the biggest sports that to be at the different tournaments around Europe. Like how much visibility is there in, you know, the general population of men in football who are out and proud? You know, I think it's close to zero, especially at an elite level. Whereas when you look at the amount of men who are playing football in the LGBT clubs and going to these tournaments, it's like the complete opposite. Like there are so many gay men involved in the sport, gay or bisexual, sorry. But these kind of LGBT tournaments, so both the Gay Games and the Euro Games, kind of provide that platform to show, here we are, this is what we do. And why don't you get involved in us and why don't you support us? Because we love sport and we can do as much for you as you can do for us. So if you're speaking to the different sports bodies in different countries, it's good to show them this is exactly what we do. This is who we are. And you should include us in all of your policies and things like that. So I'm not sure if I'm phrasing that properly, but I just think it's a legacy piece that what it can do for the different countries that tournaments go to and what it can do in terms of promoting people like me and like others in our community to take up sport and feel welcome in sport.
Absolutely. The legacy of sport is something so, so powerful, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Moving on to Emma and your own, again, I'm kind of phrasing it as coming out journey, but take us through sort of your process of getting to that stage where you were accepting yourself. And because I think it was 2019 where you publicly came out as trans.
Yeah, came out sort of publicly over social media in November 2019. I'd sort of told to family, sort of family and friends early on in the year, I guess sort of like in terms of coming to terms of it's obviously sort of a bit later in life, sort of like coming out, but I mean sort of growing up quite a bit similar to Queen and sort of knowing that I was different, inverted commas, but sort of like not really knowing in what, like sort of not being able to put anything on, like sort of a name on it, I guess. LGBT plus topics, issues weren't talked about in school. At least not my school at all. I mean, sort of growing up in the early 2000s at school, it just wasn't a topic. And it's just after Section 28. I mean, that was obviously being appealed, but it was still overhanging education. Sort of like, and there wasn't really sort of any. I didn't really know sort of like. I didn't know if I was this, that, sort of like going through all sorts of various sort of like, well, I know I'm different, but I can't quite put the sort of like my finger on it. And then it was only when, but I mean, and sort of going to university and sort of and sort of becoming more aware of sort of who I am, but still, I guess, sort of like with the overhang of growing up in sort of a time where sort of like these things were taboo, not really talked about, sort of like, I guess sort of like it had sort of like an impact on me mentally, and that sort of like it was like, okay, that this is something that's this is not this is not a good thing. This is something sort of like you could push this aside, sort of like there's a way to be normal, and it's not like it's not that. And yeah, and it did have an impact on me. And it's only been in the last 3 years or so that I've sort of like actually tried, like got accepted myself, I guess. And it's had such a huge impact on me and sort of like my outlook on life and sort of like that. It's honestly like sort of like I was thinking like then sort of like with the, I was saying to you guys earlier that it's sort of sat, currently sat in my flat in Leeds, and it's absolutely heavy, it's heavy, horrible rain outside. And it's like sort of, and like honestly for me for the, like the last 3 years in terms of accepting myself, it's like before it was like sort of like looking out a window which sort of covered in condensation, mists or fog, sort of like can't sort of like sort of see that. And then the last 3 years have been like rubbing a hole in it and sort of being able to see the world in full sort of like colour and shape and higher definition, actually being able to see a future properly. Which has made such a huge difference to me and sort of like to my mental health and also on all sorts of impacts on my life in terms of my relationship with my family, friends, work. And I guess that's sort of the part of the journey to where I am now. I mean, like there was no sort of like eureka I am trans moment, I guess, but it's just this sort of like gradual acceptance of myself and gradual realization that there's nothing wrong with me, and gradually realizing exactly who I am and sort of how I can accept myself.
The window analogy is actually quite a good analogy because it's almost preempted my next question, which is a difficult question, where it was almost like how do you describe sort of the thoughts going through your head? Like the other analogy that pops into my head is, you know, when you go get your eyes tested and you get your glasses and it's, you know, everything's a bit blurry, but then you see everything in HD kind of thing when you're wearing your glasses, and whether that's a fair analogy as well of what's going through your mind.
Yeah. Well, I don't wear glasses, so I don't know. And I'm glad that you have the window analogy because I thought it was a bit corny, but you know, I came up with it and I was quite pleased with it. But it really is like that. And it's, I know, like, people want to sort of like talk about coming out and all that sort of stuff in sort of a cinematic way or in a way that sort of like there's this great big sort of realization moment and then everything sort of like flicks from on to off, you know, but it doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen like that. I mean, I came out as trans to like some friends and then family at the start of 2019. And then it wasn't until the end of 2019 that I came out, I felt I was in a position, partly through my own choices and partly through circumstance, where I came out sort of publicly. It's like it wasn't like sort of I am entire, I like it wasn't like an overnight switch. And for some people it is. Like I know people that like literally go in to work, have gone into work one day as one person, then come in as their authentic self the next day. And but it wasn't like that for me. It was a process, and I guess it's still an ongoing process because transition takes a long time, but in terms of the acceptance of myself and in terms of my mental health, I'm in so much better position now than I was, like I say, about 3 years ago. It is like night and day.
And that's, I suppose, one of the main themes that has come out is how every person's different. Everyone's got their own individual way of, you know, getting to the place that they're at now, or getting to a place where they're feeling happier with things and specifically better with their mental health. Okay. For you, was it, I suppose, again, this is picking up on the previous interviews that you've done and some, I think, previous bits of writing, but mm-hmm. where you'd almost convinced your mind or tricked your mind into thinking that the reaction was going to be negative, and that once you get that reaction, actually, you can start building up from that and get to the place where you're at now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a naturally pessimistic person. so I was more than sort of like ready for almost complete rejection. And I think that, I think that's actually quite common among quite a few LGBT plus people, and particularly transgender people. It's the idea that you become so upset, like you become obsessed with the negative side of things, whether that be on social media or sort of like in digital media or whatever, in your own head, that it's everything's going to be the worst case scenario. And I mean, obviously, not everything's perfect, but I mean, I've felt so lucky in that I've come out and I've found acceptance from family, friends, some people quicker than others, but I've not lost friends, I've not been disowned by my family, you know, these are all sort of things that go through your head, and there's such a huge reason as to why people don't come out and why they don't express themselves in the way that they are, and why they sort of keep things bottled up and keep things and why, you know, that's why people have suffered from mental health problems in the LGBT community, and why the statistics that you said at the very start are so, you know, they're so shocking and sort of skewed in sort of like how LGBT people suffer from mental health problems so much more on average than the rest of the general population. There is obviously the issue, like people, and not everyone will be accepting, but the fact is that all I would say is that one, and you have to be in a position within yourself where you feel ready to come out, you know, no one can force you, and you should never feel as if, okay, I have to come out now because, you know, it has to happen. But once you're ready to, it is so much weight lifted off your shoulders that it's almost impossible to describe unless you've gone through it, and unless you have been able to lift that weight off your shoulders, it's almost impossible to describe how it feels and then how it feels to have it lifted.
Yeah, that brings me on to my next question as well, is then that first time where you know you've got your new name, you're applying for a job as you, and that time when you see your byline for the first time. As journalists, we all love seeing our byline, but
yes.
Special circumstances in this one. And that, again, must kind of feel like you've really taken ownership and accepted who you actually are.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in terms of the... Yeah, and in terms of coming out and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I was like the things sort of like in terms of me coming out sort of in like sort of to general public was sort of expedited by the fact that I tried to come out in a previous job in mid 2019 and it didn't go very well, and it was clear that the work environment wasn't going to be very conducive for me working in that. People in the old bosses weren't going to be good to work with, so I left. And then it was sort of like, okay, I don't want to go through that again. The only way, and the best way, and obviously the only way to go out is to apply for jobs as Emma, is to apply for jobs as myself. So and which sort of links back to what I was saying before about some like things sometimes move at different paces, but you know, through both sort of like circumstance and also and where I was ready mentally, sort of getting a position where I was able to like ready and able to come out generally, and then yeah, applying for jobs and as Emma and doing jobs there, I mean I can look back on it with almost like a fond memory, because you know I've now got a job that I really like for the last over a year. But you know, I was unemployed for 5 months and going through gender transition and trying to find jobs in sports media, which is famously one of the hardest jobs. it's one of the, you know, journalism's hard enough to get into in the first place, and then take sports journalism, football journalism, you can times that by 10. And yeah, so looking back, it was like quite a tough time. It's tough on me, tough on my family, because obviously they're worried about me and worried about my mental health. And there were some very difficult times, sort of like me and my parents sort of like for all sorts of like sort of, you know, you can add the transition thing onto the job thing, and then there's a lot going on, but then yeah, got the job at Goal, and yeah, my first day at Goal is, I look back on it very fondly, but it also happens to be the first day of lockdown one in the UK. The 23rd of March 2020 is not a very happy day for most of the UK apart from me. it was a good day. And then yeah, in terms of seeing the byline, yeah, it's the first article that I wrote, and seeing that sort of like with my actual name that I love on it, and putting that on social media into the accounts that I have under my own name, which I love, it was a euphoric moment, and obviously it's very personal, weirdly sort of personal and public, but yeah, it was such a great moment.
And in terms of lockdown as well, my current role, the website launched on the 17th of March, which was the first day of working from home. So I can certainly relate to that in some ways. Exactly. My final question for you before we move on is essentially how are you now? Because you mentioned earlier on about sort of still, you know, getting there, still gradually building up who you are. Is there a way to kind of describe how you are now relative to where you were?
I feel like I'm going somewhere in life, which I didn't for like quite a few years in my 20s, even though like sort of say work was going very well and all that kind of stuff. It's like, I felt sort of like, there wasn't really sort of much of a future that I was looking forward to. And now that there is, because I'm sort of going through this, I've got the gender transition process started and all sorts of like sort of the healthcare side of it's going fine. You know, it's in the UK, the NHS's provisions for trans healthcare are not perfect, to say the very least. So you could do a whole other podcast about that, but it's I am actually in the process of getting somewhere. And also in terms of the lockdown, obviously I moved to Leeds and it was first time in a new job as Emma, and you know, in a new sort of like city as myself. And then lockdown happened, and obviously can't sort of the life that I was looking forward to in Leeds was put very much on hold for a long time. And that was quite difficult. But now that's obviously everything's starting to open up again. And actually, to bring it to something that Karina said, sport for me has been extremely important in terms of my well-being, and also getting to know other people in the LGBT plus community, because I play for a football team, Yorkshire Terriers, who play in the GFSN, which is the Gay Football Supporters Network League, which is a national league in the UK of teams from various cities around the UK who like sort of play in the league and cups and semi-final stuff like that. And it's LGBT plus inclusive clubs. And joining that team, I played for the team in Newcastle very briefly, Newcastle Panthers, and then moved to Leeds and joined Yorkshire Terriers. And that has been a huge, huge part of my life here. And it's partly just for the, you know, for what sport brings anyone who does it, like going to training every week, the exercise, the mental well-being, the being with other people, but also like being in an LGBT community. I mean, there are community groups and like stuff like that, but to have sort of like that community and have it in the football context has been huge for me as well. And we've got the much delayed 2020 Cup semi-final at the end of this month against East End Phoenix from London, which very much looking forward to. But Karina is absolutely right in terms of how important sport is within the LGBT community, because I felt that firsthand over the last year for certain.
Exactly. So many benefits to sport, honestly. I feel like we have made several podcasts over the course of our existence touching on that, but summed up perfectly well there. We're just going to jump from this conversation to hear from Martin Stark now, as he talks about his own coming out journey, but also his pathway into boxing after nearly dying in 2017.
This podcast is a member of The Bear, internet radio and podcast network. Find more great podcasts at thebear.live.
Martin, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for lending your voice to this particular series of podcasts on mental health awareness, particularly Mental Health Awareness Week. I'll start with your own personal story first, and basically, I suppose how people used to say, and this is one quote I've picked up from you in previous interviews about Martin, who couldn't punch his way out of a paper bag. So how does that Martin become current Martin, who's so ingrained in boxing and
I guess the first thing I'd like to do is just thank you for the opportunity. It's evening here in Sydney. I'm in Australia, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where I currently am, the Gammeraygal people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. I'd like to extend that respect to all Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander and First Nations people. In answer to the question in one word, how that Martin was couldn't punch me out of the way of the paper bag, to organising a world boxing competition, is courage. That's probably the biggest change. I have the rare autoimmune condition, Addison's disease, which is what JFK had. My body doesn't produce cortisol. In 2006, I had gallstones blocking my liver, and I had a procedure to try and remove some of the stones. Unfortunately, dye seeped into my pancreas. I developed septic shock, pancreatitis, was placed in 2 induced comas. One of those, prior to the second induced coma, I had a tracheotomy, and I was aware when the tracheotomy was performed. The experience I had with being in induced comas were the dreams. So I had PTSD, A, from almost dying several times whilst I was in intensive care, but also the dreams of being in induced coma. Over the last 15 years, I've had about 70 hospital admissions from major surgeries and Addison's disease. But at the end of 2017, I almost died. So in Australia, I think it's the same in the UK, when you go to emergency, they have that area called resus. So I was almost died, and my pulse was below 40. You can imagine what's going into your mind was, I know the next stage for this is I'm back in that induced coma. That would be the only thing that would basically keep, luckily I had great medical attention, but I had a bit of PTSD. So to overcome that, I approached my local martial arts center, a few self-defense classes, and the second class just happened to be boxing. I was always the last one to be picked at school sports for things like soccer and all those other games. I'm a gay guy, can't throw a catch. I was good at swimming and athletics. But boxing was never something I would even contemplate, but I found I could do boxing. Had a few more lessons and just continued the journey. And through that became the person I am today.
And putting it down to that incident where you nearly died back in 2017, massive thing for anyone to go through, to be faced with that. Is that where you mentioned the courage side of thing, but was that sort of bringing out a whole new side to you, where it's kind of, you know, now or never type thing?
Yeah, I'm the type, I used to describe it, I was somebody who was confident part of the time. I was the perfectionist. Unless I could reach my own standard, I always judge really my capability, my pride, my self-esteem on what I could achieve. So if I could master something, it was great. But otherwise, I didn't realize I was actually achieving or doing great things. I just thought I was doing okay, and I couldn't reach my own standard. And I remember reading a performance review, and I was getting high achiever. I was always getting the top grades, the top marks in, you know, my performance reviews, getting great bonuses. But it said, I wish Martin would be more courageous. And I'm the type of person, I just took straight away. So I just started being a bit more courageous in what I did. And I noticed the change. And then I really started thinking, how could I be more courageous in different ways outside of the work environment? And really, boxing became the vehicle. And I describe courage through my own framework, which I call PACE, which is passion, action, creates confidence and excellence. If you think, when you're passionate about something, you will find the time to do it. You know, whether it's learning to drive, doing something new, going to the gym, you will find the time. Now, we've always had those moments where you think about something and you do it. So you start taking action. And rather than being the perfectionist, it's more about that confidence, creating excellence. And that was my own way to courage.
Exactly. And it certainly seems to have panned out. Why the self-defense course out of anything?
I think it was just a way of being able to channel the emotion that I've been having. So I can't describe the feeling of being placed in an induced coma and not knowing if you're going to wake up.
It's, yeah, incredibly hard thing to describe.
Incredibly hard thing to describe. Now, can you imagine then being taken into a second induced coma and having a tracheotomy, being aware of them performing it, being sedated, but still being aware of them performing it, and then knowing what's next is that second induced coma. So I've had to fight in many ways for my health. I've always been like, health, have those breaks, get back to the gym, live life to the max. I've always wanted to achieve, but that fight has always been there. And going through those experiences, and it was a way of kind of breaking the emotion. I remember speaking to a psychologist, said, why am I feeling like this again? She goes, because you're creating a memory, linking another memory. So the memories of being in induced comas, of having a cancer scare, of having major surgery, then being diagnosed with a rare water immune condition. There's only so much people can think they can take, but I believe we're more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. So that the fight, it wasn't to actually learn, it was just actually just to do something different. And I discovered a new passion.
Is that essentially part of the key to why you are where you are now, is that you had something to channel that energy into that was positive, where so much had perhaps been not so much fear, but, you know, worrying what's going to happen next type thing? So
I think worrying was always there. And I'd already embraced courage really before I started that, but it was literally to try and do something very, very different that I'd never done before. And I discovered I was good at it and I enjoyed it. And I started cataloging my journey on Instagram. You know, the hashtag gay boxing had fewer than 1,000 posts when I started boxing training. Yet boxing had, 20 million posts on Instagram. And then I just started thinking, what do I do next? And I just, the thing people would not expect me to do was boxing. But I found it something I was very good at. I loved, I enjoyed, and I really enjoy the boxing community, particularly here in Australia, which is very welcoming and inclusive.
Mm-hmm. And that brings me on to, I suppose, life growing up, if you like, and coming to accept yourself. And it's a story. It's not necessarily just with people from an LGBTQ background, but I've heard so many stories about sort of that nagging self-doubt, like you were talking about in the corner, and occasionally it holding back people. And suddenly the switch happens when they just believe in themselves and stop listening to like the outside noise, like you were talking about there. Is that very much sort of your journey from a younger age, is just coming to terms with that, accepting yourself for who you are, and ultimately doing things for yourself rather than others?
So, I mean, I came out at the age of 27. I should have come out a few years earlier. Everybody has their own journey. Now, one thing that is great is we've got more advanced rights now than we ever had. You know, I think the UK has decriminalised male homosexuality in 1967, but it took until the 1990s till they even lowered the age of consent down to 18. I think that was 1993. So I remember the first representation of gay men on television was Colin and Barry on EastEnders. I remember when there was a kiss on the cheek and it was national outrage. So the culture was very different then, very less accepting. Then there was Section 28, you know, that horrible law that said basically teachers could not help gay students. It kept people in the closet. So the environment was very different then, very, very different. So you sense the environment, and then I just didn't feel comfortable opening up and acknowledging who I was until a later age. But we all have our own journey. I mean, I feared coming out, but the experience with my family was the exact opposite. You know, very welcoming, very accepting. But we have to define our own pathway and work out what we want to do. And it's what we're talking about earlier, whether you're going to listen to those other people, or do you really want to do something for yourself? I sometimes describe it as being selfish and generous. as I believe we should be purposeful and give back, where you do something for yourself, but you create an opportunity for somebody else. Now, coming out of the closet is the most selfless thing you will do, because you are telling your family, your friends, who you are. For all of those years you've been hiding and fearing, and it's fear. It's absolute fear for many people, being rejected. Some people don't even make it. Some people end their lives before they even come out of the closet.
Like you say, you sum that up really well with the selfishly generous phrase there. And did it feel like a massive weight off your shoulders when you did eventually come out?
I think I was just ready. And it was just my own journey. I lived in Australia for a few years, so we were able to explore both sexuality and just making that self-determination for me and thinking, look, this is who I am and now I'm ready. I think there was a lot of pressure on people to come out still. But I still think people should be respected, but it's about creating that environment where people can be accepted and can come out without fear and harassment. You know, 20 years ago in the UK, it was very different. In 2000, it was in 1990 for LGBTQ people. But Section 28 was still law. You know, there's only just over, it took four people to go to the European Court of Human Rights to get the ban on gay men and women serving in the military overturned. There's a lot of prejudice that people have had to fight against to secure rights. And it's, well, we have in Sydney, we have the Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, which is a beautiful pride parade. You have pride in London, but imagine people actually, that first pride parade, you know, it was about human rights. One of my favorite British films is Pride. If you think, I remember the mine strike in the 1980s, but if you think about it, was the gays and lesbians supporting the miners, helping the people in Wales, and then the National Union of Mine Workers joining a gay pride event in the 1980s and helping push forward LGBTQ equality at the Labour Party conference. You know, it's that solidarity. It's about people coming together, but prejudice is always there. Hatred is never far away. The 2019-20 FA Premier League season, reported homophobic incidents increased by 93%. Racist incidents increased by 53%. Don't think hate isn't far away. We live in a more tolerant, accepting society, but social media has really given a platform for people to be bullied, harassed. If you look at the other week, the courage of the soccer clubs, BT Sport, Sky Sports, to take a break from social media because of effectively racism. Yet the European Super League was stopped in a few days because fans were outraged over that. Why are people not outraged over hate and doing enough to, because you could combat it within a few days. Social media companies could do so much more if governments, Prince William, Prince, if they spoke out against racism in sport and homophobia in sport rather than the European Super League, that would be more impactful than what they did the few weeks ago.
You're listening to Sportspiel's Mental Health Awareness Week podcast specials. Go to our website or follow us on social media to catch all 5 episodes throughout the week and help raise awareness using the hashtag Mental Health Awareness Week. You can find all those links and resources in the show notes of this podcast episode. Okay, so we'll bring it back to unpicking some of the issues, the talking points. And this is an incredibly broad question, and it feels a bit unfair to ask it, to be honest. And because the situation is so different across so many different sports. But how inclusive do we feel sport is right now? And I suppose it depends on geography a lot of the time as well. If Karina, I'd fire that one at you first.
Are we talking specifically for the LGBTI plus community or? Yeah.
Yes.
You know, again, I think you could break it down like into even how inclusive is it for the lesbian community, the gay male community, the transgender community, because even though we're just, as I said, such a big community with so many different needs and so many different challenges that, you know, as a lesbian, I suppose there in Ireland, I recently took part, and the EGLSF asked me to take part in Lesbian Visibility Week and to name my lesbian superhero in sports. And I had to do out a list, and I was like, who am I going to pick? Because there are so many high level athletes in Ireland who are lesbians, who are out and proud, and there's no secrets about it, that I had an easy choice. I already mentioned earlier about, if you're a gay male player and you're asked the same question, that your choices would be limited. So, and then same if you're a transgender person in sport in terms of visibility. Again, who would you pick? I suppose you obviously know people, but you definitely don't have the same level of choices. So depending on where you are in the LGBTI plus community, there's going to be more visibility for you. And then when you look at that, you know, when you delve deeper, then that does tie back to inclusivity. Why are there not a lot of trans people visible in sport? Because sport is not very inclusive for members of the transgender community. Mm-hmm. I think things are getting a little bit better. As I mentioned, Sport Ireland are doing a piece of research on it, asking community members what needs to be done, which is exactly how I think these kind of exercises need to work, that you need to reach out to the people you're targeting and ask them, how can we make it more inclusive for you? I just think it's pretty inclusive for some people and not as inclusive for others within our community. And then again, you talked about geography. There's no LGBT sports clubs where I live now, so I don't have access to any LGBT sports clubs. It's as simple as that, unless I try and get something set up as the restrictions lift. That does cause a barrier for me if I want to play sports with my peers. And I do just feel, you know, I can't explain it, but I do just feel this drive to play sports with people in the LGBTI plus community more than I would with a regular sports club. And it's a difficult one to name out. And then the other benefit of the LGBT sports clubs in terms of inclusion is that if you've never played a game of rugby before, you can still join the Emerald Warriors. If you don't know the rules, it doesn't matter. Same with the soccer clubs and the Pink Ladies hockeys and all this. You don't need to know how to play the sport to in your 30s to rock up to the sports clubs and take it up. I know from my local soccer team, from the women's team, or, you know, the Camogie team, which is the Irish sport, you know, it's not so easy to rock up if you haven't been playing, that these are a team that have been playing for years. Especially, again, I don't know if you know Camogie and hurling, it's a very technical game with a stick and a ball, and that is not, you're not going to take it up. And I haven't played it in like 20 years now. So I can't join that club. I can't be included in that club because they don't want me, because I can't, nothing to do with my sexuality, but because I'm a beginner. So you just kind of have to recognize the inclusivity piece there in terms of what the LGBT sports clubs offer versus your general population sports club who don't always take on beginners. I guess it's a difficult question to answer, but I do think a lot more work needs to be done in terms of visibility, and that I think it needs to be broken down into different LGBTQIA plus community is too broad. You need to break it down into different sectors, and how do we make it more inclusive for this sector and do it that way.
That's something you go along with, Emma, specifically, I suppose, the importance of the visibility side of things.
Yeah. In terms of inclusive, it's so difficult. I mean, obviously, and even from a transgender perspective, you've got the issue in that so much of sport is gendered, and then you've got the whole sort of issue of transgender sort of people competing in the gender that they identify with. And then there's that whole debate in inverted commas, which has particularly in the States and obviously and here as well, and that's the whole other matter. I mean, yeah, in terms of, yeah, it is difficult because obviously it's trying to provide that sort of sporting access for people. And I mean, take for example the team that I play for here in Leeds. I mean, there's one LGBT plus inclusive football team covering the whole of Yorkshire, which is a lot of people. But it's okay for me, sort of like being from Leeds, it's not too far for me to travel. But you know, if you're traveling from, you know, somewhere in the Dales or whatever, it's difficult because trying to create that balance between, you know, it's a difficult balancing act in terms of how much provision there needs to be, you know, how many teams and then sort of what the quality of teams is. I mean, is the focus going to be more on sort of inclusivity and getting people to play sports, or do you want to be competitive? And, you know, it's obviously playing on a competitive league and stuff like that. And it's a lot to consider, and it's a difficult balancing act. So and Karina's absolutely right in terms of visibility and sort of from playing sport. I mean, you can reel off lists of sort of lesbian sports stars, you know, if there's too many to mention, and then gay male sports stars, you could probably, you know, in obviously famously in British football, there aren't currently at the top level. And then, yeah, it's so difficult. And I mean, you know, creating that sort of environment in which people feel ready and sort of like able to be themselves is so important to do. And I think, and actually to look at it from how I often watch sport, which is from sort of the fan perspective, there are a lot of I've recently spoken to and done interviews with fan groups for LGBT plus fan groups for Premier League clubs, and there's a lot of good work that they're attempting to do in terms of making going to watch sport, we're going to watch football, sort of a less intimidating and daunting prospect for people. I mean, like, because people want to go and watch sport without sort of like feeling uncomfortable, without feeling sort of like as if there's going to be trouble. And I mean, and from speaking to those fan groups, most clubs are attempting to, professional clubs are making at least some sort of attempt to encourage more fans from a greater sort of like background and spectrum, and make people more welcome at the grounds. And I think that actually a lot of it has to come from the players, both in terms of creating a players in sport, in terms of creating a positive atmosphere and a welcoming sort of an atmosphere, both for fellow players and for fans. And you speak, when a footballer, whoever, comes out and says, yes, our team is LGBT inclusive, we don't have any problems with any, we wouldn't have a problem with any gay players in our team, that creates such an important message. Like speaking to the fans of Liverpool, for example, when Jordan Henderson came out and said, look, being like we accept being gay should not be an issue in football, whether as a player or as a fan, and that sort of thing creates such a big difference.
That it makes me think automatically to social media, because it's something that we've inevitably talked about on pretty much all of these mental health awareness episodes. It plays such a massive part in all of our lives, particularly right now when a lot of our lives are online and virtual, and it's essentially what we've got to still try and connect with people when we have had to stay shut in our own homes for a large part of the year. And bearing in mind we're recording this what, 1 week on from the social media boycott that a lot of football authorities and a lot of other sports took part in last weekend with regards to abuse and things like that, how do we see the state of social media right now, particularly maybe homing in on the homophobia, transphobia side of things, the atmosphere that you alluded to, Emma, and making sure the atmosphere is welcoming? Where are we at with that? How much work do we still need to do, or how much work still needs to go into making somewhere like that a welcoming environment for people?
God, yeah, I think a much higher level of regulation is needed. I can give an example. Just recently, I don't have her name now, the transgender Olympic weightlifter who recently potentially qualified for Japan. Yeah. It was in, do you know?
Yeah, Lowell Hubbard.
Yeah. I saw that tweeted a number of times on social media, which is fantastic, but I dared not read the comments because I know that people can write whatever they want on that about that person and have absolutely no consequences for their actions whatsoever. And from reading the few interviews I read with her, she seems like a really quiet, maybe introverted person who does not want any attention. But because the policies or inclusion and of transgender people in sport hasn't been put to the forefront over the last few years, she is now essentially going to be used as a punching bag on social media. And especially if she goes to the Olympics, if they go ahead, that she will be used, held up as an example. First of all, from our perspective as a role model, but she will get, without a doubt, a truckload of abuse over the next couple of months. And that's the sad reality of it. There's no point in denying it's going to go any other way. And that is a sad point of social media, is that it can be used to abuse people. And of course, if we're talking about mental health, you don't have to be, you know, a famous athlete to get that abuse. You can just tweet the wrong thing one day and you are suddenly on the naughty list. And then, yeah, that the effect that that has, there's no point in saying, well, I don't care what someone on social media says about me. They don't know me. Because you do, you get upset by it. So I think that there's major problems there. And I think it needs to come from a higher level, a higher authority in terms of what needs to be done there to support people. Because when you leave it to the individual, it's difficult. So it's always like, regulate your own social media use. Don't go on social media. But we all know it's addictive. We all know that you get dopamine hits and things like that from going on it repeatedly, and that's why you pick up your phone all the time. We all know that it's so smart that if you've been looking up articles on, hacking your sleep or whatever, that it's going to throw more articles on similar topics or the same topics back up at you and stuff like that, or you'll suggest people to follow that are, related to topics that you've been looking at. So I think it's just very smart, it's unregulated, and a lot needs to be done there in terms of mental health. It needs to be start trying out more positive mental health focused ideas in how we're going to manage it. And I, as I said, I do my best. I actually have my little phone here. I have an old, won't see it on the podcast, but an old Nokia that I bought at the start
it's retro lockdown. Everyone, by the way.
Retro Nokia 3210 or whatever it is. But because I can't actually, with my smartphone, just turn off my data or my Wi-Fi for an hour and say, I'm just going to put the phone in my pocket and not look at it. Like, I can't do that. And I'm like, my God, I'm in my 30s and I can't control my phone use. And that's because of social media and what it has done to our brains. Like, I honestly believe that there's some science behind this. I've listened to it and heard about it, and that we are addicted in many ways to it, but we don't look at it as a problem. We look at it as harmless, although maybe not so much now. It is kind of getting more notoriety. And that is my way of trying to do my piece, by taking my SIM card and putting in a different phone. And then I leave my smartphone miles away from me. And I can tell you, it's a tip I would give to absolutely everybody, because you're not tempted when it's nowhere near you, and that you are still contactable, which is the excuse a lot of people use. Oh, what if someone needs to ring me? So you're still able to contact the people you love as well. And we've been going off the topic there, social media, but it's harmful. It needs regulation. And I don't know who's the right person. Who's going to do that? That'd be the question I would ask.
Yeah, again, it's a big question. But like you say, it's why it comes up in every single discussion, because it does just play such a huge part in our lives and our mental health. Mm. And I've said this before, I'm not shy in saying it, that I don't use Facebook anymore, because I got fed up with it, particularly in my role as a journalist. I've said this before on the show too, but the time when I was threatened to be stabbed by the friend of someone who I reported on in court, who was up in court for stabbing someone. So, things like that. I didn't like how a lot of my professional life was invading my personal life as well. So I just did away with it. Likewise, the phone side of things, I have do not disturb settings on my phone now. So it goes off after 9 o'clock at night, and that's it. I know I've got a peaceful evening. But Emma, I imagine, particularly from the journalism and social media side of things as well, because we have to be in it, don't we?
Yes.
We have to have those profiles. Mm-hmm. It's something that we just have to get used to, I suppose, and manage as best we can.
Yeah. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always said that I wouldn't be on Twitter if it wasn't necessary for my job. But the fact is, for journalists, being on Twitter, being on Facebook is essential, because that's how you make contact with people. That's how you keep track of things. It was so weird sort of having the social media blackout, having it happening, particularly for football journalists during the Manchester United protests. It completely changed the dynamic in terms of, and in terms of sort of how the news was covered and all that sort of stuff. So it's essential. But I think it's also quite a double-edged sword, because I think that in terms of particularly the coverage of transgender people, in sport, a lot of it is influenced by the fact that journalists spend a lot of time on social media and they see transgender people through the prism of how they're represented on social media, both through anti-trans accounts and anti-trans movements, and you know, prominent people and organisations who are very vocal and very active on social media and sort of present things in a certain way there, and also, you know, certain the way that sort of like trying to argue with or have a conversation with anyone on social media is hamstrung by the medium, and you know, I think that the way that transgender people like and LGBT and by extension LGBT people as a whole are represented in the media has been hugely influenced by the way that can be viewed often through social media and often in a very negative way. Because I think you know, a lot of the time you see that sort of like people who write about transgender people or about transgender issues haven't actually spoken to anyone who is trans, but have sort of like got their information from social media or sort of like the way that it's presented through that. So that's had a huge impact. But you know, at the same time, social media can be extremely positive for some people. I mean, I've had the way that the articles that have been recently published about with the LGBT Premier League fan groups, the sort of like the, you know, you've had sort of like the trolls sort of underneath saying, why are you covering this? This is terrible, this is bad. And then you've had people responding to them saying, actually, we really support like this, and sort of really support the idea of people being able to go to football matches as themselves, and sort of like these groups there to support people. And those have been, you know, getting a lot more likes and a lot more sort of, you know, people standing up and sort of saying, now I support people being who they are and being able to go and support a football team without sort of fear of harassment or anything like that. I think that sort of like in terms of LGBT inclusion in sport, I mean, greater exposure and greater sort of like numbers of LGBT people competing in sport can only lead to greater awareness, greater sort of like acceptance, and it can only be a good thing. Gay women competing in football, tennis, whatever it's not even slightly an issue, because there have been so many fantastic gay athletes that like people realize that it's just not an issue. And I think I think it'll be the same with transgender athletes as well. I actually covered the In and Out job in the Pacific Games in Samoa, at which Noel Hubbard was a competitor because she's from New Zealand, and she won a couple of gold medals there in weightlifting, and you know, and the coverage that she got for her was negative press, negative coverage from the local media, and actually the president of Samoa in his closing address at the closing ceremony sort of like said, we need greater sort of investigation, sort of like research into transgender people competing in sport, which on the one hand was a surprisingly political comment, it's a pointed comment to make in a closing ceremony address, but also on the other hand it's good that these discussions are happening, and they're happening not through people shouting it, just through people shouting each other on social media, but through actual like sort of being played, like they're topics that are being forced to be discussed at sort of the highest levels of sport, and people are, you know, they're realizing that, you know, that being trans is not an automatic advantage. I mean, like for example, Lola Hubbard, she's ranked 16th in the world in her weight class. And so you've got people sort of saying, oh no, it's going to be terrible that she's going to, you know, it's going to completely skew the Olympics. It's going to make a farce of it. Well, she's far, far from guaranteed to even qualify. and certainly not likely to make the final or compete for medals, you know, unless she has a fantastic tournament. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that the only way that sort of like people grow to accept LGBT people in sport, transgender people in sport, is through them doing and competing and being visible in the sport, and you know, and the argument sort of like of social media. Obviously, that's a lead-off point, but it's not going to be where things are decided.
Can I just say there on that point that Emma made about discussions happening on social media? That is probably the biggest problem, in that it's not a safe space. And that these discussions need to be had, and not just on LGBT in sport, on, you know, women's rights, Black Lives Matter, things like that. Discussions need to be had, but not in the manner that they're being had on social media. It's just the wrong platform, but that's what people seem to use it for. But specifically, take Twitter and Facebook there, maybe not so much Instagram, but yeah, just wanted to jump on that.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, the fact that everyone's on social media, everyone's opinion is out there, and you can pick and choose which opinions are right. and in the end, you just, like with social media, try not to make it too much of an echo chamber. Try to follow people who I don't necessarily agree with, you know, but obviously not everyone does that. And it's so, like, social media is not a good place to open yourself up to new ideas, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
On that as well, those discussions on social media, is there perhaps too much of an emphasis on elite sport, and we're ignoring grassroots sport to some extent, when, you know, someone from a trans background, you know, and all the discussion is around, oh, they might beat someone to a world gold medal, but actually that narrative is blocking a lot of people who might just get into grassroots sport, which is beneficial for their mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose if you think about, like, the transgender person who just wants to play soccer for the local junior B team and go out with them at the weekends, they are still affected by policies that would affect an elite soccer player, or maybe that's what's going to happen. And that when you, I suppose, even myself, when I think about inclusion in sport for all of our community, I would often think of the elite levels before thinking of the grassroots level, even though the vast, vast majority of our community are looking to play at the grassroots level. But I suppose from a sporting pride perspective, that's why some of our events are on the elite athletes. But we're also trying to do more events with the local sports clubs, the LGBT sports clubs as well, because they have such an important part to play. And they also influence national governing bodies and Sport Ireland and all that, in terms of look what we can do. So, yeah, I do think maybe the discussion is possibly from the general population is possibly always going to focus, or will for the meantime, on the elite athletes. But I think in the long run, you know, you need to take a larger look at our community, and the fact that the vast majority of us, like myself, want to play sports outside of these LGBT clubs. And how do you make the local sports club more inclusive for me, and to make me feel safer, or just welcome, not safer or whatever, but rather than just looking at elite athletes in my community, and that haven't been the sole focus of policy and inclusion going forward.
Definitely right. And I mean, you look at the sort of the grander population, then what population of that are LGBT playing people, like grander population, people who play sport, LGBT people who play sports, LGBT people who play sport at an elite level. And it's like that the policies are primed for people like sort of it, or particularly for transgender people, like primed for this number of people, but actually it impacts this number of people. And And I think it does put people off, because I mean, if you, like, sort of, for example, at the club that I play for, there's about 100 people in the Facebook group, sort of like the players' Facebook group, about 20, 25 of them sort of like go to training with any sort of regularity, and there's two of us who are transgender. And it seems like, I know that there probably aren't that many transgender people interested in football in Yorkshire, but I'm pretty sure there has to be more than two. Yeah, at least two. And I think that people are, and I do think people do get put off by how negative a lot of the coverage of LGBT people in sport is, and particularly coverage of trans people in sport is.
Definitely, yeah. I think the focus a lot in the past has been on elite athletes, specifically because, you know, when you're a teenager and you're looking up to a group of people, like, you'd love to see like a high level football player from Liverpool or whatever coming out publicly and being out and proud. But, you know, that's because a lot of young people who may be growing up in the teams don't know about the LGBT sports clubs, and that there are actually people who are just like them who will never play for Liverpool, but who are playing soccer in an LGBT sports club. But historically, for me, that's why I didn't know about these clubs in Dublin growing up. But if I had seen an elite level athlete coming out, that would have been amazing to me, because I love sports. They're just like me. Therefore, I can be who I want to be. But yeah, it would be nicer if more people around the country knew about these LGBT sports clubs and the grassroots players. But again, that's difficult for a young person, say, growing up in my town, thinking, oh, that's great. They have clubs in Dublin and Cork and Belfast and places like that, but they still don't have anyone here for me. But it would still help in terms of just knowing that these people are playing sports and I can get involved in this and I can stay where I'm at and stay engaged in my sport and it's safe for me. So, yeah, I think a focus on both would be great. Rather than such a high focus on elite, a balance would be nice.
Mental Health Awareness Week is hosted by the Mental Health Foundation. You can find more information and support it at www.mentalhealth.org.uk. How do we see social media at the moment? Because it's got, like you say, it's got a lot of negatives to it, and it's so easy for people to spread that hatred and target individuals. But then it's trying to remember the positives as well when you can get shrouded in so much negativity right now.
I think it's applying a filter. The internet and social media are not always real life. You put your phone down, you go to your local coffee shop, you go to the gym, you have a conversation with a friend. To me, that's more meaningful than spending time arguing with somebody. I remember last year I was in hospital with Addison's disease. Out.com had published a story about me in boxing. And it was funny because, and I don't know why this guy who is supposedly straight, he is now like criticizing World Gay Boxing Championships. And we're exchanging. And like, it was like having a conversation with the troll. After about the fourth exchange, this guy realized the person he is criticizing is me.
Sums it out, doesn't it?
So, and his tone changes. He's like, wow, it's you. And he said, you have that courage. And it comes back to that courage. Have the courage to switch off, to move away, block a troll. Don't give them the attention. I often have a strategy if I will engage maybe once or twice, but I want a troll to have the final word. I want a hater to have the final word, because it shows to me that I've moved on. I don't really care. But also, they're in their own echo chamber. If that your final thought is hate, that's not a good place for anybody to be in.
That I really like that message, actually. Because so often, you know, people think we must have the final word type thing to win the argument type thing. But I suppose it's, again, courage, being courageous in yourself and knowing where you are individually to be able to walk away when needed.
Yeah. One of the phrases I tell myself is let the negativity drive you. You know, if that person is saying that they're against this, I'm like, well, what's that person actually saying? It's a reflection on them. They're trying to make you feel worse so they can feel better. If somebody was being rude to you, abusing you in the street, would you just stand there and allow that person to continue, or would you walk away? Now, I would say most people would stand up for themselves and probably walk away and report them, because that person really isn't worth it. And that's the thing, it's about reporting. Not enough people are prepared to actually report incidents, not obviously to speak up and speak out against racism and homophobia and hatred. Being an ally, you know, changing hearts and minds. We've all been in those situations where we've been bullied and one person spoke up for you. How did you feel when that person spoke up for you? And why would you not do that for another human being?
Shall we move on to the World Gay Boxing Championships now? which you're obviously the founder of. And you mentioned there at the earlier on about the hashtag gay boxing and it having so many, you know, X amounts of uses versus the absolute mammoth amounts of uses of just boxing in general. Is that one of the reasons why it came about? Because I know you were trying for the gay games and then it got taken off the list of sports.
So literally wanted to go to the gay games, competing, because starting with boxing, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do? So let's go to the gay games. And I was calling myself the future world gay boxing champion. Just having fun, really loving the sport. And then I'm in hospital, had an understanding crisis after training. And I just messaged the gay games, say, hey, what are your weight divisions, all of those things? And the message came back, look, really sorry, but there are only so many sports that we can have and boxing didn't make the cut. So I'm just like, okay, why don't I just create the world's first LGBTQ boxing competition and call it the World Gay Boxing Championships. And I just started writing a few articles, posting it to social media, particularly LinkedIn. That's my platform of choice. And it just started getting a bit of traction. Interviewed for an LGBT or one of the gay magazines in Sydney, and then just started bringing this thing together. And then last year created the World Gay Boxing Championships as a not-for-profit. So we're not profit limited by guarantee. Then I started approaching the boxing community. So I reached out to Boxing Australia, which is the peak body for the sport in this country. Initially, it was a email, a Zoom call, another email. And then I get a message back saying the whole board of Boxing Australia welcomes you and wants to support you to do this event. And they issued a media statement. I was interviewed by The Guardian, I was interviewed by BBC World Service, BBC Sport, and then just suddenly it's getting all of the publicity out there because I'm constantly delivering the message. And then we're building and growing a beautiful LGBTQI plus boxing community, but we're building allies. One of my best friends in Sydney is the president of Boxing New South Wales. I describe it as a family waiting or friends that we haven't not yet met. So the boxing community has extended the hand of friendship to the LGBTQI plus community, wanting to help us organise it and run this event. We've got 62 people registered from 7 countries. Now, I'm pretty relentless. I won't kind of back down when it comes to our community. So I just started emailing the world professional bodies. Had a meeting with the president of the International Boxing Organization. This is a great Zoom call. He issued a statement. I just contacted the World Boxing Council just on their generic email. Within 2 days, I had a personal video from the international chair of WBC Cares Division, have a letter of support. And then I just start contacting the others and I get a message of support from the World Boxing Organization and had a personal letter from the president of the World Boxing Association. Now, whilst that's all very at the elite level, we're amateur and grassroots. For me, it was important that we asserted our presence and started to form those relationships. And it was just a case of just keep going out, keen out there, communicating. We're working on a business plan and project plan and have my first fight on the 26th of June. There are so many allies out there wanting to help the LGBTQI plus sporting community, particularly in the Australian boxing community.
And I suppose with boxing, people can so easily jump to conclusions, I think, about it being this, yeah, you know, male-dominated sport, quite brutal sport. But it's so refreshing to hear how many hands have been reached out to help you get this thing off the ground and make it what it is now.
So I think a couple of things I'll say to that. At the moment, I still feel for LGBTQ sport and representation, the onus is still at the elite level or professional athletes, people who've competed at the Olympics or world championships or soccer players. And I get disappointed because the real story of sport is the community level, the grassroots level. How many people will get to compete at the Olympics? Not very many. So we put the pressure on those athletes to come out and represent. Whereas the gay games have been going for over almost 40 years. How about the people who've gone to the gay games or set up an LGBTQ club or just happen to be an LGBTQ person and they participate, they go to the gym or they participate? Those are the real stories in sport, in my view. That's where the heart of sport happens. You think about soccer in the UK, it's like the weekends, you know, the Saturday, Sunday leagues for kids to play sport, to participate in soccer. Swimming was my sport. We used to have the swimming carnivals at the weekends. That's where it all starts. That's where most people participate. But those stories are very rarely told.
On a previous interview that I heard that you did, you mentioned Kelly Maloney as one example. Yeah. And I suppose how much of an influence someone like that can be in the position that she's in, the position she's held in boxing for so long, and whether that can go a long way to changing those hearts and minds at the same time, particularly in the way she's supporting things like that.
Kelly is a huge influence, huge positive influence. Now, we've become close friends. You know, she's been advising me on the championships. We're in regular contact. But Kelly, so courageous. And she's offered to help train some of the UK peeps who want to participate in the championships. There's a real ally for trans inclusion in sport, real ally for LGBTQ people in sport. But has achieved so much in boxing. You know, Lennox Lewis was the undisputed heavyweight champion, represented by Frank Maloney, who always has been in Kelly. So for Kelly just to be so courageous, she loves the sport of boxing. Kelly is Kelly participating in boxing. She was Frank for a big part of her life, but she's Kelly. Always has been Kelly.
Likewise. And the courage, common theme here, to actually come out and be who she really is, I think was always... I remember that when she first revealed to everyone.
It seems that banning is a solution. I get very cross when I see... And it comes back to that elite level again. It comes back to a trans woman is going to prevent a woman winning an Olympic gold medal. Now, I'm not going to go into that debate, but what I will say is when athletes are condemning trans people from participating in sport, the conversation seems to be world champion, Olympics. But really, most people participate in sport, going to the local gym, going to the local pool. Do you not want trans people to train? Do you not want trans people to be able to go to the boxing gym and hit the pads and the bags? Or if you're against trans people participating in the Olympic Games, but you're passionate about your sport, why don't you offer classes for trans people to learn to swim, to learn how to box, to learn how to run better? So there's this thing that you're going to try and ban a group of people from participating, but then you say you're not transphobic. So prove it by enabling participation, enabling inclusion. And if you spend time with people, you might learn something. You might open your own heart and mind a little bit. And maybe they could learn something from you to be a better swimmer, to be a better boxer, to be a better athlete. But I'm not seeing that. All I'm seeing is lots of complaints and lots of things around banning. And we think about 20 US states are wanting to ban trans kids from participating in sport. And I think that's so cruel.
That brings me on to the next question, which I've been asking everybody, because the theme for this year's Mental Health Awareness Week is nature and the environment. Again, you can understand why that's the theme, considering the year that a lot of people have had. How has nature helped you in terms of balancing where your mental health is at if you're having a particularly stressful week or a particularly down day?
I'm very lucky that where I live, if I walk right 10 minutes up the road, I see the Opera House and Harbour Bridge. If I walk left 10 minutes, I'm one of the best beaches in Sydney. So me being close to water. I don't enjoy swimming at the minute, but I have a big affinity to water and the calmness of the Pacific Ocean every single day when I go out. So also, I think the thing with nature, I had a really bad fear of snakes. And 2 years ago, I went to Wildlife Park in the centre of Sydney, and I held a snake. I touched a snake twice, and then I had the snake wrap around my arm. Well, a couple of months ago, I went back to that same wildlife park, and I said, look, I just want to really master my fear, and kind of held a snake, and they brought out a diamond python, and I held a snake in my hand. And it was a little bit of apprehension, but felt very empowering. And this snake was trusting me. Its body was, it was very comfortable, and it was in my hands. So like, why am I scared of this animal? It's not a brown snake. It's not a death adder. Things that we have, some of the most venomous snakes, dangerous snakes in the world. Here is a harmless python that is trusting me. It's been its natural self with me. So I think it's trying to find those environments where you can be your natural self, listen to the birds, all of those things. You can go to the park or whatever. For me, it's the water is probably where I feel the most calm.
Absolutely. And I can relate to that a lot, actually, because living in Essex now, as I do, where I grew up and where I'm back now, but I was at university in Dundee by the water. And honestly, it was so nice. Just, you know, you're looking out from your flat and you can see the river. And it's something yeah. about it, isn't it? Even, you know, I'm not the biggest swimmer either, but just seeing it just adds a whole sense of calmness to your day anyway. In terms of finishing off the conversation, in terms of advice that you might have for people who are maybe struggling to find that courage or struggling to accept themselves for who they are, or perhaps facing some of that negativity, criticism, abuse on social media, what advice would you have in terms of, you know, putting the noise to one side, trusting in yourself, and helping yourself get into a better place?
So I use a strategy which I call the courage bank, which is those memories, think about times you've been courageous, think of those moments. If you go for a job interview, they ask you a situation where you achieved an outcome. You have all of those memories. Times you've done something. Fear is a great source of information. It can guide you into making the right decision. And part of that decision could be to stop doing something, to continue to do something, or to change something. To think about those moments, relatable experiences. Feel comfortable to walk away, move away from the situation, spend less time on social media, but also have the courage within yourself to be you. And accept who you are, accept all of those flaws, accept every exam you have failed, everything you have done badly at, everything that you have made such a hash of has brought to you to where you are right now. All of those bad moments, all of those failings, and where people said you've done the wrong thing, you are here right now. We think about the successes and how many exams you've passed, but think about those exams where you failed or you didn't get the grades or you didn't get this, but you're doing what you are doing right now through all of those experiences. Now, if you want to come out the closet, I always say make sure your physical and psychological safety is there, but it's your own journey to make, nobody else's journey to make.
My final kind of talking points, if you like, before I wrap up this episode, and it's more floating it back onto your own individual experiences, really, with your mental health and coming to accept yourself. What do you think are the biggest lessons you've learned along the way from your own experiences? Karina, if I start with you.
Probably a big piece around accepting yourself and personal acceptance. And this is the thing when I talk about this, and anything I say has already been said a million times, or for anyone listening that you've already read articles about these kind of different kind of important information, but it's kind of putting these things into practice is the hard bit. So self-acceptance is a big piece. So even out and proud when I'm in Dublin, it can actually be that bit more difficult when I'm back in Shannon. And there's I have my friend Dave, who's an LGBTQ plus community member, but there's no community here, and that I'm not so comfortable being here. But then some days I am, I'm like super out and proud. And other days I'm like, oh no, I'm the only gay in the village kind of stuff. So that acceptance piece for me is my mental health is in a much better space when I feel like I've accepted myself and know I am who I am. other life learnings. I won't go on about my old school Nokia. That's actually just been a major piece in terms of mining my mental health. I just absolutely love it. And disengaging, not just from social media, but technology in general. Technology is obviously very useful. Like, would you have ever even heard of Sporting Pride without technology? Probably not. But I definitely think it has its downfalls and that it needs to be managed a little bit better. Is it learnings since COVID or learnings?
Just along your journey. Yeah, your life
journey.
Learning.
Okay. Probably another life learning then is in relation to peer support. I know I touched on it earlier as well, but there is nothing like it, I think, in the LGBTQ plus community about finding yourself in other people, your commonalities, your life experiences. I think if you go back even as far back as the AIDS crisis back in, you know, the 80s and 90s, you'd often hear stories about, you know, friends as family. Like, a lot of these people are, mostly men, I suppose, were essentially abandoned by families and that they had to rely on other community members. And I know things have gotten a lot better for us, obviously, in recent decades. But I still think there's a feeling in our community that those friendships are much closer. We have much closer bonds, maybe. I don't know what it is, but there is definitely a sense there that we definitely take our friendships with our peers. You know, their brotherhoods, their sisterhoods, their family to us. And that's an important piece for anyone who hasn't, I suppose, linked in. Not only with a sports club, by the way, like, but any, there's lots of different peer support groups available out there. But linking in with like-minded people, I think, is very important. And finally, yeah, just asking for help when you need it, I suppose, and reaching out. That's something I didn't do, as I said, all through my teens. I just went into myself and never once spoke about my sexuality for, you know, almost a decade or whatever. And that, as I said, I said it earlier as well, it's a regret and I wish I had reached out sooner. And I remind myself of that now when I go through other struggles, that when you did reach out at that point, things got better for you. So just keep reaching out when you were struggling and open up and let people know that you want to say something, you have something to say and that you need support. So that'd be it for me.
So that's some very worthwhile advice there, I think. And Emma.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree regarding sort of like just reaching out and sort of talking and you know, like talking about like problems and sort of like communicating. And there's nothing worse in terms of like the idea of sort of keep calm, carry on, or keeping quiet, sort of like just keep slip up lip, all that kind of stuff. It's all a terrible idea, terrible advice. You know, talk, be open. Yeah, it's so much better to be that way. And I think what I've also learned is in terms of sport is that it is like for so long it was the idea that okay, I have like I can either be LGBT or I can be involved in sport, like they have to be separate. And it's in fact there's having the two together, and that is so much that is possible, and it's so much better to have it that way. And that's just in terms of the best lesson that's what it is for me is the idea that you shouldn't just have to feel as if you can only bring certain parts of your life, certain parts of yourself. You can only bring certain parts of yourself into certain parts of your life. You know, you can be yourself in all walks of life, and in sports, you can be yourself, and it's. And that's so much of a better way to be.
Yeah, I really like that one. Is that you don't have to pick one or the other, do you? You can have it all. And my final topic, really, because this Mental Health Awareness Week, the theme of it is nature. So it's something where we're asking everyone, how has nature, or being in the great outdoors, if you like, how has that benefited you and your mental health, and how have you managed to factor that in to your days?
Yep. So as I said, I think I mentioned as well earlier that I'm very lucky to live by a river walk. I compare this to my time living in Dublin, where you lived in the city. And the big difference that's made to me being able to go out every morning with the dog and to connect. I suppose, to be honest, I find it difficult to connect with nature sometimes, you know, depending on where my head is at. I'm not going to pretend that, oh, yeah, I'm always lovey-dovey in nature. Sometimes I leave the house and I come back and I don't connect at all. And I just have zoned out for my whole walk. But it's when I do go out and when I purposefully practice mindfulness on my walk that I can feel connected to nature, that I know it does have a big impact on my mental health and my setup for the day, because my walks are always first thing in the morning. And there are certain elements of nature, I suppose, that would appeal to me or that would bring me back to the present moment that much more than others, such as, you know, the water. I think a lot of people have said swimming has become another one of those popular sports in cold water. So I've always loved swimming since I only got back into swimming in 2016, but I've loved it ever since. And I must say, once you get into that water and you feel in the present moment, sometimes, depending on the day, that can be the only moment I'd have in a full day where I felt, you know, alive. And this is the moment. This is, you know, you're just breathing heavy or whatever, and you just feel like it's something amazing that can get you set up for the rest of your day. And another piece of nature, again, I'm just picking out little pieces because I said it can be difficult to connect and that you have to find what works for you. Certain trees, like cherry blossom trees, I think at the springtime of year when they start blooming, it always reminds me of how fleeting life is. And that is, you know, if you look at Japanese culture, that is the message that those trees give, that we're here for a short time and life is fleeting and make the most of it. And then, you know, you pass. And I know, sorry, I hope that doesn't sound depressing, but nature can remind you of that because nature is constantly changing and it just accepts itself and it lives and it dies and it comes back. And it's just something that I think we all need to connect with. I think we're very, I won't go down global warming or talking about anything like that. I think we're very disconnected and I have been for a long time. So finding those little elements that work for me and that help me feel connected to nature definitely makes me feel a lot better. I appreciate everything that I have in the locality that I have, and I wish more people could experience that because I don't think that they do. I don't think enough people are connected. And we can connect that back to our social media and our technology chats as well, because people are too busy looking down at their phones while they're out. But yeah, I would put down the phone and go out for your walk and find the different pieces that might work for you, because nature is beautiful, and just, you know, do connect.
I definitely agree with Queen on that. I live sort of on the outskirts of Leeds, and it's quite a, you know, I live quite near an industrial park, and sort of like various sort of manufacturers, factories, stuff like that. It feels like not the most nature heavy sort of part of Leeds, but going out sort of like on walks and going out sort of like getting out of the flat as far as allowed during lockdown, found actually there was some fantastic naturals. There was some fantastic green areas, fantastic areas of sort of natural beauty, just sort of like turning off sort of like the main road and going down sort of like a side alley sort of thing, like, you know, going down like one of those sort of public footpaths sort of like things, you know, just slightly veering off the beaten track and finding some fantastic areas. And I think that's part of what like nature means to me, is the idea that sometimes to find the best parts of life in terms of finding nature and everything else is to go slightly off what you would expect and sort of like slightly off what the main sort of like main road, mainstream is. Yeah, there's a, it's, and it's just the my favorite walk near where I live here in Leeds. You go out sort of where I am, you head up the road for about 10 minutes. It's like this dusty sort of main road, sort of like with a lot of sort of like trucks going off for sort of like the industrial sort of areas nearby. And then up on the left hand side, there's a what looks like basically someone's driveway. And so you sort of feel a bit awkward going up there, like you're sort of trespassing, but there's actually just at the end of it, there's a public footpath, sort of like with style gate, you head over that, and all of a sudden in sort of like in a bit like farmland, sort of a bit and rural land, and it's the most beautiful green area. And heading there and finding that during the summer for me was such a huge, it made such a huge impact for me and sort of on my mental health and stuff like that, knowing that I didn't have to sort of like be stuck in this pokey little flat or sort of like stuck in sort of like this, like go in somewhere and find somewhere really beautiful and green and just sort of like take in that and take that in and sort of like be more in touch with nature and sort of like be, you know, just enjoy sort of like like the natural beauty of the area, in an area where you wouldn't necessarily expect to find it.
Honestly, I only put that question in at the start of this whole series just because it was the theme of the week. And there's been so many interesting answers to it as well, and so many things you can pick up. Like, I've never thought cherry blossom trees would come into an answer. And even, you know, some of our guests doing gardening and growing their own food during lockdown just to try and help soothe their minds. So many different aspects to it, which is really brilliant to see. Speaking personally, I've learned so much from this particular conversation. Likewise, so many important bits of advice I think that a load of listeners can take away and apply. And yeah, whether it's courage, whether it's confidence in yourself, trying to be open about whatever it is you're going through, there are so many important messages that deserve to be shouted from atop the rooftops. So thank you again for opening up, because I always have such huge respect for people who are able to do that, because it is a massive personal thing to put out there in the first place. So thank you so much. Before I wrap it up, resources for anyone who needs them, whether it's mental health support, helplines, are as always in the show notes of this particular episode. But yeah, ultimately, thank you again to everyone on this podcast for sharing their experiences. Thank you everyone again also for tuning in and listening to what we've been doing. Please spread the word if you can. Take care. Hope is on the horizon, certainly with restrictions easing. But look after yourselves, and thank you for tuning into this Mental Health Awareness special.